The senior Iranian military commander warns Israel that if it starts an armed conflict with the Islamic Republic, it will lead to the destruction of the Zionist regime. Lebanon's resistance movement Hezbollah says Saudi Arabia fabricated a crisis over comments by a Lebanese minister over the Saudi war on Yemen. Also in headlines, Belarus threatening to retaliate against any new European Union sanctions, including by shutting down the transit of natural gas by the country. It's good to have you with us. A top story this hour, a senior commander of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps has dismissed repeated Israeli threats against this country.
Among all the countries around the world, the Zionist regime is the only entity that talks about its survival and existence. A regime that talks about its very existence must not speak about other countries. And the threats they issue against Iran are to please their domestic audience. They know that they can be the starters of a conflict, but we will be the ones to finish it. And the end will be the destruction of the Zionist regime.
Top Brigadier General Amir Ali Hajizadeh, who is also commander of the IRGC's Aerospace Division, noted that Iran enjoys exemplary security, and the country's drones are a thorn in the side of the enemies. The top commander added, the fact that some countries are seeking to negotiate Iran's missile program and have imposed arms embargo on it is a testimony of Tehran's defense capabilities. Now, Russia says that the United States needs to review its sanctions policy against Iran if it really wants to revive the 2015 nuclear deal.
Political will is now required. From the U.S. side, it is important to prove and demonstrate in practice that the sanctions policy which has been carried out over the recent years is being reviewed, and the Iranian side is given the opportunity to reap those economic advantages that are included in the package of agreements that lies at the heart of the JCPOA.
Ryabkov says the parties must try their best to restore the deal in its original form. He also said that Iran should take measures to clarify to the parties that there is no deviation from the deal's parameters. Ryabkov says that the new round of the JCPOA revival talks must build on the progress made during the previous rounds in Vienna. Iran and the remaining signatories held six rounds of talks between April and July. The new negotiations are set to start on the 29th of November. Tehran says that the upcoming meeting will be limited to efforts on removing anti-Iran sanctions unilaterally imposed by the U.S. following its exit from the deal. Time now for the news review section. The leader of the Lebanese resistance movement, Hezbollah, says that Saudi Arabia fabricated a crisis over a minister's criticism of the kingdom's war on Yemen.
From the beginning, it was not an issue of statements of this information minister or that minister. They were looking for an excuse to create a certain crisis with Lebanon. These are two things that lead to the same objective, to the same results. When we come to this crisis that was created by Saudi Arabia and this continuous pressure on Lebanon, this is part of the confrontation and this battle with the resistance.
Sayed Hassan Nasrallah called a baseless lie to Saudi claim that Lebanon is being controlled by Hezbollah. He accused the kingdom of seeking to provoke a civil war by pushing his allies in Lebanon to stand against the resistance movement. Last month, Lebanese Information Minister George Kordahi slammed the Saudi-led onslaught on Yemen. The criticism angered Riyadh, which expelled the Lebanese ambassador and blocked imports from Lebanon. Hezbollah chief also pointed out Israel's existential concerns in the region.
They are trying to breathe through the normalization of ties with some of the Arab regimes, but the Israelis, in the depth of their minds, they know that all of these regions and these countries which are normalizing ties with them cannot protect their occupation, cannot protect their walls from the men of the resistance in Lebanon and Palestine and the entire region.
And Nasrallah says that Israel is very much concerned about the strategic strength of the regional resistance front that's threatening its existence. said the regime carries out drills once every few months near the Lebanese border out of fear. He added that these are testimonies that the resistance movement has become a force to be reckoned with. Okay, that was the highlights of Nasrallah's speech. Let me invite a couple of guests and ask them their thoughts on that. So joining me will be Zafar Bangash, director of the Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought in Toronto. And also we'll be joined by Robert Cantina, author and journalist in Kitchener, Ontario. Welcome to the show, gentlemen. Let me turn to Toronto. Mr. Bangash, let's have your initial thoughts on status on Nasrallah's comments. He talked about Israel fearing more the Lebanese could attack in northern parts of the occupied territories and capture it. Also regarding what the Saudis have been doing to create further tension and chaos in Lebanon.
Kind of support or approval to a people's resistance movement. They fear that that might inspire their own people to rise up against their own repressive government. That is why they have overreacted to the statement by the Lebanese official who condemned and criticized the Saudi Arabian continued slaughter of the people of Yemen. This criticism is just, it is valid. Saudi Arabia is committing war crimes there, and it is certainly within the rights and obligations of other nations to criticize it. So the leader of the Lebanese resistance movement, Hezbollah, who criticized Saudi involvement in that war, the Saudi waging of that war, it was acting in complete legitimate ways. Saudi Arabia will oppose any resistance movements. That's why there was a great overreaction. The withdrawal of the recalling of the ambassador, the blocking of imports. It's complete overreaction, but the reason for it is not the statement, it's who the statement came from.
Okay, now. Mr. Bangash, go ahead with your comments. Looks like that the technical problem is taken care of. No, we don't have a good connection with Mr. Bangash, unfortunately. Let's go back to Robert Fenton. Now, Robert, Israel, when it's talking about its existence and also threats surrounding it, the Hezbollah leader was discussing the fact that when there is a country that's always concerned with this and preoccupied with this, it kind of sends you some signals.
Well, there are a few things. Israel wants to be seen as a vulnerable potential victim in the Middle East. Poor little Israel surrounded by these Arab countries that only want to destroy it. There is no truth in this whatsoever. Israel is a powerful nation backed by the most powerful in the world. Israel holds international law in contempt. Israeli leaders say they're concerned about their own existence, the existence of Israel, yet they are on a daily basis slowly destroying the existence of Palestine, but they don't recognize that at all. So it's kind of doublespeak. They want to pretend that or present themselves as the victims when actually they're victimizing the people of Palestine, and would also, certainly they have concerns about Hezbollah in Lebanon and the force that that country has, but to look at everything that happens as a threat to their existence is just an old talking point that is worn. It's cliche, and people aren't buying it anymore. Mm-hmm.
Robert, there was also another point in Mr. Nasrallah's speech, and that was Saudis claiming that they are a friend of Lebanon. At the same time, he was criticizing them for not offering any help as regards the energy crisis besetting Lebanon, you know, for quite some time, whereas he said that Syria and Iran did so, and they offered and delivered some help so that they could kind of alleviate the problem they had with fuel.
Saudi Arabia will say that it is a friend of Lebanon, but we have to look at their actions, and those that you've just mentioned are certainly indicative of the fact that they don't care about the people of Lebanon. They would like to see Lebanon defeated, become a satellite or a puppet government of the United States. People of Lebanon, they didn't do it. So there is no way that they can say they are reliable allies or good friends with Lebanon. It's simply a talking point that, again, isn't believed much beyond their own circles.
Okay. Now, we have Mr. Zafar Bangash on the phone now. Mr. Bangash, go ahead.
Yes. Well, in terms of the Saudi attitude towards Lebanon, there is little doubt that the Saudis want to provoke a civil war in Lebanon because they fear that the resistance front, of which Hezbollah is a very major component, is getting stronger. And the Saudis are clearly aligned with the Zionist regime in occupied Palestine, as well as their allies in the region that have so-called normalized their relations with the Zionist regime. Whereas the Zionist regime itself is greatly worried because it knows that the resistance front is getting stronger. And if there is another war, that might actually bring about the end of the Zionist regime as we know it. So in that sense, the Saudis are playing a dirty role. If you look at their record, they have actually caused massive disruptions throughout the Muslim world, whether it is in support of the Takfiri terrorist groups, whether it is unleashing a war on Yemen, or letting these Takfiris, financing the Takfiris in Syria. Anywhere that the Saudis have been involved in, their role has been extremely disruptive. So they are actually acting as the enemy of the Muslims everywhere, Yemen, Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, you name it. And so in that sense, I'm afraid the Saudi regime is playing a very, very negative and nasty role.
Okay, thank you very much for your comments. That's all the time we had for this news review. So let me thank our guests. We had Zafar Bangash, director of the Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought in Toronto, and Robert Fantina, author and journalist from Kitchener, Ontario. In other news, Belarus has threatened to retaliate any new European Union sanctions against Minsk, saying that such a move will lead to the shutting down of the transit of natural gas by that country.
We have increased the volumes of natural gas pumped via Belarus. The Yamal-Europe pipeline is full. We are heating Europe and they are threatening that they will close the border. And what if we block the supply of natural gas there? If they impose additional sanctions on us, indigestible and unacceptable for us, we must respond.
President Alexander Lukashenko also hit Europe with fresh rebuke, saying that while Belarus is warming the continent, the 27-member bloc is threatening Minsk. The escalation followed amid a migrant crisis on the Belarusian border with EU member Poland. Lukashenko also claimed that the migrants on the border had been receiving weapons and explosives from conflict-hit eastern Ukraine. The president called on the Belarusian military to be vigilant. A warning came after the EU said it would hit Belarus with fresh sanctions next week over the migrant crisis.
The European Union will expand and tighten its sanctions against Lukashenko's regime. This is what we will decide at our foreign ministers' meeting in Brussels on Monday.
Moss noted that there are other options on the table, including the expansion of current sanctions, especially the economic ones. On the other hand, Lukashenko accuses the EU of trying to shift the blame on the country to justify its new sanctions. Poland accuses Minsk of state terrorism for allegedly using intimidation to force migrants to breach the border. Belarus says, however, that Poland is violating international norms by blocking the migrants and beating them back with force. Thousands of asylum seekers remain stuck near the Belarusian border with Poland in freezing weather. Guards and police forces are deployed on the Polish side to block the migrants from entering the EU. Germany is joining the list of European countries dealing with an uptick in COVID infections and deaths. Just in the past day, the country has had more than 50,000 new infections. Some 230 people also died of the disease during the same period. Germany's overall death toll has now exceeded 97,000. The overall caseload is close to the grim milestone of 5 million. Experts are warning if the aggressive fourth wave is not contained, Germany could see 100,000 more fatalities. There are concerns that the surge could overwhelm hospitals and even force the postponement of surgeries. New Delhi has sent thousands of additional forces to Indian-administered Kashmir after the deadly October violence in that region killed nearly 40 people. The growing surveillance of Kashmir residents in and around Srinagar has also sparked fear and panic among the people there. Our correspondent has the story.
Scores of surveillance bunkers, checkpoints, and frequent frisking of residents and vehicles have made life difficult in Indian-administered Kashmir. Following the deadly October violence in and around Indian-administered Kashmir, New Delhi has tightened security in the region. More than 20,000 paramilitary forces, CRPF, and some 5,000 border security forces, BSF, have been called into action. The paramilitaries have occupied locations in the residential areas, a move that has raised concerns among the residents.
It's a serious life threat to all of us. The entire neighborhood will collapse if any sort of unexpected incident happens.
Authorities say these measures are taken to avoid further civilian deaths.
Deployment.
Forces have been in Kashmir since 1947. The only reason to call the additional forces sometimes is to make Kashmir secure for its residents. Bunkers are constructed against potential terrorist acts. Last month, around a dozen civilians were killed. The presence of forces will therefore ensure a sense of security among the residents.
However, residents complain about the humiliating and disrespectful behavior of the security forces.
In Guzarakis, authorities should accommodate or relocate the entire neighborhood. The presence of troops around our homes has made us gripped. Not only this, the usual frisking on roads is also disturbing our mental peace, and we are often being humiliated. The entire population is looked at through the prism of terrorism and terrorists.
Kashmir is the world's largest militarized zone and the longest pending dispute. India and Pakistan have fought wars over the territory since the partition of the subcontinent in 1947. The two countries rule the region in parts but claim it in full. After the abrogation of Kashmir's special status in August 2019, New Delhi promised equality to the people of Kashmir. Analysts say 2 years on, people of Kashmir have instead developed a deeper sense of insecurity and alienation. And so far, New Delhi has done least to address their grievances. Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
And that brings us to the end of this news broadcast from Tehran.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The limelight. The United Nations Climate Conference in Glasgow, Scotland, has become a venue for world leaders and business executives to pretend they're taking action on climate change. Without following through, the climate activist Greta Thunberg said on Thursday, 4th of November. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Jenny Gross. She has also written for the Wall Street Journal. The piece is titled, Greta Thunberg Says Climate Talks Are Becoming a Greenwash Campaign. United Nations Climate Conference in Glasgow, Scotland has become a venue for world leaders and business executives to pretend they're taking action on climate change without following through, the climate activist Greta Thunberg said on Thursday, 4th of November. Speaking on the sidelines of the summit in Glasgow, known as COP26, the 18-year-old Ms. Thunberg said the event was sort of turning into a greenwash campaign, a public relations campaign for business leaders and politicians. Since we're so far from what actually we needed, I think what would be considered a success would be if people realize what a failure this COP summit is, Ms. Thunberg said. At panel events on Thursday, 4th of November, at the New York Times Climate Hub in Glasgow, Ms. Thunberg and other young female activists, including Vanessa Nakate and Malala Yousafzai, also spoke about the critical role that young women have played in the rallying protests and pressuring world leaders to take action. It is the young people, especially young women, who are the voices of the climate movement, and that gives hope to so many people, Ms. Malala Yousafzai said. The comments came on the fifth day of the summit meeting, a gathering that John Kerry, the United States climate envoy, had billed as the planet's last best chance to curb the fossil fuel emissions that are driving climate change. More than 39,000 diplomats, business leaders, and activists have registered for the event in hopes of hammering out agreements to reduce emissions and keep the average global temperature from rising above 1.5 degrees Celsius compared to pre-industrial levels by the end of this century. That's the threshold beyond which many scientists say the planet will experience catastrophic effects from heat waves, droughts, wildfires, and flooding. The average global temperature has already risen by 1.1 degrees Celsius. Far, world leaders and business executives have made some significant commitments. On Tuesday, 2nd of November, more than 100 countries agreed to cut emissions of methane, a potent greenhouse gas, by 30% by 2030. And on Wednesday, 3rd of November, a coalition of the world's biggest investors, banks and insurers that collectively control $130 trillion said they were committed to financing projects that would help get companies and countries to net zero emissions by 2050. Environmentalists, however, criticized the financing pledge as lacking in detail. Several key leaders, including Chinese President Xi Jinping and Russian President Vladimir Putin and Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro, were also criticized for not attending the event in person in Glasgow. Environmentalists say that China and Russia's targets are not ambitious enough, and they're also skeptical about Jair Bolsonaro will follow through on his country's pledge to end deforestation by 2028. Vanessa Nakate, a 24-year-old climate activist from Uganda and founder of the Africa-based Rise Up movement, said at the panel discussion on Thursday that the pledge by world leaders of the 20 largest economies to pursue efforts to keep the average global temperature rise to 1.5 degrees Celsius did not go far enough. Vanessa Nakate said that 1.5 degrees would not be safe for communities like hers. Even right now, it's already evident that climate crisis is ravaging different parts of the African continent, Ms. Nakate said. Malala Yousafzai, a 24-year-old, said women were disproportionately impacted by the climate crisis. Treating climate change and gender inequality and girls' education as separate issues is not doing justice to the cause of creating a fairer and better and cleaner world for all of us. Malala Yousafzai said, "It is important that we take these issues seriously and see the link between all of these." She and other activists on Thursday said there were reasons for hope. When the moderator at Ms. Thunberg's event asked what one fact the panelists would want everyone in the world to know, she said that people should understand that their individual actions can make a difference. the changes that are necessary will not come from inside conferences like COP26 in Glasgow, she said. This is the misconception, Greta Thunberg said, that what we as individuals do doesn't have an impact. And I'm not talking about not using plastic and so on. I'm talking about going out onto the streets and making our voices heard, organizing marches and demanding change.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now let's listen to Sheikh Salim Bimji.
Tonight, the topic I want to revolve around, that I want to reflect upon, is the deception of this world. How is this world a deception? Or rather, even, is it a deception? And if so, how is it a deception? And who made it a deception? And how do we navigate in this world if it is a deceptive world, if it is a world which is trying to get us to follow it rather than following Allah? So if you have your Quran with you, chapter 35, verse number 5, Allah says, Ya ayyuhan nas. Allah is speaking to humanity. You know, and one of the things that we have to get accustomed to when we read the Quran is to look at the words Allah uses. Sometimes Allah addresses the Ahlul Kitab, the Jews and Christians. Kul ya Ahlul Kitab, Allah says. Sometimes He addresses the Kuffar, the disbelievers. Kul ya Ayyuhal Kafirun. Other times He addresses the believers. Ya Ayyuhal Ladina Amanu, O you who have believed. But other times Allah gives a universal declaration. Ya Ayyuhal Nas, Ya Ayyuhal Insan. O humanity, O the human beings, all of you as a collective. This is one of those verses, Ya ayyuhan nas, inna wa'dallahi haqq. O humanity, recognize that the promise of Allah, the promise of your God, is a true promise. That promise that Allah has given that we will go back to Him is a true promise. But then what does Allah say? He says, فَلَا تَغُرَّنَّكُمُ الْحَيَاةُ الدُّنْيَا. People, Muslims, non-Muslims, Jews, Christians, atheists, agnostics, Hindus, Buddhists, whatever religion you follow, recognize that this world, this Hayat al-Dunya, the world of the temporal life that we lead, do not let this world delude you. Do not let it distract you from the true goal. وَلَا يَغُرَّنَّكُمْ بِاللَّهِ الْغُرُورِ. And do not let the deceiver, the many deceivers that are out there, especially Shaitan, Iblis, the devil, Satan, do not let him mislead you, misguide you, deviate you, delude you from the path, from your conceptions about Allah, from your understanding of your eternal home after the life of this world. Now, one of the challenges that believers face, and I mean all of humanity really, I would say, faces this, all believers, whether you're a believer in Christianity or Judaism or Islam or another Abrahamic religion particularly, is the balance between living Hayat al-Dunya, living the life of the world, and living as a individual who recognizes that they will die and that they will stand in front of Allah on the Day of Judgment to be accountable. It's a difficult balance for many of us to do. Because we know we come into this world, we go to school, we go to university, we get a great education. And so many of our youth obviously make the most of this opportunity, which our parents, our forefathers did not have. But the challenge becomes, is how do we ensure that we do not let the dunya delude us? All of these things are there, but then on the other side of the equation is Allah, is Jannah, is the Ridwan min Allah, the pleasure of Allah, the pleasure of God. How do we put these two in a balance? Again, we live in very difficult times. Had it even not been for the COVID-19 pandemic, I would still be talking about this, because this is a challenge of the era that we live in. We have so much to do, but we find so little time in our day to get things done. And many times, unfortunately, whether we like it or not, Allah takes a back seat. Because we say, well, I have to go to school. I don't have a room to pray my salat in. We have to go to work. There's nowhere to make wudu to pray at work. We go on vacation. We don't want to, for example, pray salat outside because we're in the national park or we're doing whatever we're doing. So how do we balance this world and ensure that we fulfill our religious obligations? How do we recognize the world as being a delusion or something that's trying to delude us rather, trying to misguide us, trying to mislead us? Now, there's no doubt that Allah created the dunya and everything within it. He created all of the things that may divert us from His remembrance. He created all of these things. But ultimately, as we will see in the discussion for tonight, that we need to recognize where we have obstacles that we have to overcome. We have to recognize the fact that Allah has created this dunya. He created earth. He has put all of the beauty within the earth. But the goal is to be able to balance the life of this world and use the things in this dunya to make our akhirat. And we have to realize, brothers and sisters, that it's not an easy task. And many of us are working on that road to try and get to that level. But it's a difficult road. And it's a long road. And as Allah says, Ya ayyuhal insan, innaka kadihun ila rabbika kadhan famulaqi. That, oh human being, you are all toiling on towards your Lord, working towards Allah, working to get to that level, and you will reach Allah. So this world, what is it all about? You know, I think the best way for me to describe to you what this dunya is, what this world is, the only really way that I could really describe it for you, other than the ayat of the Quran and the verse which we will look at very briefly from chapter 57, Surah Al-Hadid, the chapter of iron, is to give you an introduction in the words of the commander of the faithful, the man who is the master of words and who had a mastery over words, and a man who has been able to describe this world for us like no one else has done, probably before him and without a doubt after him. And so in the book Ghurrul al-Hikam, which is a collection of sayings of the commander of the faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, may God's peace and blessings be upon him, he has a tradition. It's a bit of a lengthy tradition. I'm just going to give you four words in the tradition, the beginning four words that Amir al-Mu'mineen says about this world. He says in this very powerful tradition, in the four words, he says, Ad-dunya taghurru wa tadhurru wa tamurru. Ad-dunya, this world, is three things. Taghurru, it deceives. Tadhurru, it harms. Wa tamurru, it passes by. Really, if this is all we could take from this lecture tonight, this would probably be enough. That this is the reality of the world that we live in, the hayatu dunya, the material world, the temporal world. Again, we don't want to say that we hate the world. We don't want to, you know, despise the world in that sense that it is a creation of Allah. We use it to the minimal that we need to survive to get to Allah, but we don't make over usage of it. So Amir al-Mu'mineen says, Ad-dunya taghurru wa tadhurru wa tamurru. The world deceives, it hurts, it harms, and then it passes by. And if we look at it from that perspective, we realize that this world is, again, temporary. Our life here is temporary. Even if you become a billionaire, you will still die. You'll still be buried in the same grave, the size of grave as a person who made, you know, a regular 5 or 6 figure income. But again, we don't want to say that we don't work or live in this world. No, we also, and we will look at that near to the end, that we have to have a balance in our life. But we have to realize the delusions that this world can give us, the false hopes and aspirations that are a part and a parcel of this world. And if we can learn what they are and navigate and be able to make our way through this maze of life, then I think we'll be able to get to that level where we can deal with our difficulties in our lives through the Quran, through the Prophet's teachings, through the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt of Muhammad and Ali Muhammad, alayhim wassalatu wassalam.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Azim Alimun Halim Hakimun Mateen شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The tale of two Californias has never been clearer. As San Francisco Bay Area technology workers set up home offices to avoid coronavirus exposure, grocers, farm workers, and warehouse employees in the Central Valley never stopped reporting to job sites. Renters pleaded for eviction relief, while urban officials fled for suburbs and resort towns, taking advantage of record low interest rates to buy bigger and better homes. Most of California State's 6 million public school children are learning remotely, while affluent families opted for private classrooms that are up and running. The article you're about to hear has been written by Mackenzie Mays, a journalist working for the Politico website. The article has been taken from the Politico.com website. The piece is titled Pandemic Reveals Tale of Two Californias Like Never Before. The tale of two Californias has never been clearer. As San Francisco Bay Area technology workers set up home offices to avoid coronavirus exposure, grocers, farm workers, and warehouse employees in the Central Valley never stopped reporting to job sites. Renters pleaded for eviction relief while urban professionals fled to suburbs and resort towns, taking advantage of record low interest rates to buy bigger and better homes. Most of California's 6 million public school children are learning remotely, while affluent families opted for private classrooms that are up and running. California has long been a picture of inequality, but the pandemic has widened the gap in ways few could have imagined. While other states face large budget deficits, California has a $15 billion surplus, thanks to record 2020 gains from Silicon Valley and white-collar workers who pay the bulk of California's taxes. Governor Gavin Newsom unveiled the state's record-high $227 billion budget last week, despite a year in which unemployment soared beyond 10%, and the homelessness crisis reached devastating levels in the city of Los Angeles and beyond. Gavin Newsom has proposed directing much of California's bounty towards struggling residents and low-income families, and it remains to be seen whether the state will continue to reap similar tax rewards in future years. If this is a one-time windfall, Newsom and lawmakers will have to find other resources to sustain additional aid and face pressure to raise tax rates even more on the wealthy. There's a way in which the pandemic has amplified all of these systematic and societal issues we were always aware of, said Brandon Green, director of the Racial and Economic Justice Program at the ACLU of Northern California. These gaps persist and are widening, and if it can happen here, in a blue state where you have the political capital, it can happen anywhere in the United States. California's low-income workers and people of color have borne the brunt of both the economic fallout of the recession and the physical toll of the coronavirus itself. The Latino COVID-19 death rate is 22% higher than the statewide average, and the black death rate is 16% higher, according to California's Health Equity Tracker. Even before the pandemic, zip codes home to just 2% of California's population held 20% of the state's net worth, according to the nonpartisan Legislative Analyst Office. In 2020, more than 40% of households making less than $40,000 annually saw reduced work hours or pay, and an equal share had to cut back on food, according to the Public Policy Institute of California. Decades-long inequalities, those pre-existing conditions around race, around ethnicity, and the pre-existing conditions around wealth disparities and income disparities, obviously have come to the fore and must be addressed, Gavin Newsom said whilst outlining his budget proposal last week. Just moments later, Governor Newsom made a stark proclamation about how the other side is doing. The folks at the top are doing pretty damn well, he said. Governor Gavin Newsom, a 53-year-old, is a multimillionaire businessman in addition to being governor, and his own personal life has punctuated the extreme differences in California. His dinner at the French Laundry in November not only enraged the public for his flouting of his own advice against gathering, it served as an optics problem with menu prices that many Californians cannot afford even in normal times. Gavin Newsom sent his own children back to private classrooms in late October, while most California families were stuck in remote learning. When he had to quarantine in November, he said he was blessed because we have many rooms in his Sacramento County home. However, the Democratic governor has prided himself on bridging the equity gap and has branded his efforts as California for All since taking office 2 years ago. He appointed the state's first Surgeon General, Nadine Burke Harris, who has focused her career on addressing childhood trauma in disadvantaged communities and led vaccine discussions mindful of equal distribution. Gavin Newsom has pushed hard to reopen public schools this spring because he says students in low-income neighborhoods are struggling the most with distance learning. Governor Newsom has proposed $600 state stimulus checks to nearly 4 million low-income workers as part of his budget plan. He launched an effort to shelter tens of thousands of homeless Californians in hotel rooms when the outbreak began, and then transitioned towards a program that would convert that into permanent housing. He helped enact renter protections from eviction and wants to extend those protections. Californians saw an array of relief in 2020 as all levels of government tried to lessen the burden. Children who live in communities that have long gone without broadband and quality internet access received hotspots and other Wi-Fi access. Cities stopped using parking tickets and towing as a way to bring in revenue. More lower-level offenders were freed from prisons and jails after the coronavirus outbreak. Advocates say the jarring juxtaposition in the pandemic as the state's richest got richer and its poor got poorer prove it's not enough. They are lobbying Gavin Newsom and the legislature to use California's unexpected windfall to help the state's neediest by expanding the social safety net and to turn temporary relief granted during the pandemic into permanent solutions. They worry that momentum is already losing steam, and that things will revert to normal when the vaccine reaches the masses and COVID-19 is in the past. These things that were implemented as a kind of lifeline are now expiring and folks still need it, said Jehumpa Bhattacharya, a vice president of the Insight Center for Community Economic Development based in Oakland. Bhattacharya added, "We live in a society where we don't believe in government intervention, and there's this narrative that you can pull yourself up by your bootstraps. When the pandemic hit, we saw that's not true. And my hope is that we will be able to develop a new understanding of how our society works." California Democrats have proposed bigger taxes on the ultra-rich as a solution, with groups like the California Teachers Association pushing last year for legislation to hike taxes for residents with more than $30 million in assets. That bill failed, but Assemblymember Luz Rivas just proposed raising taxes on corporations by $2 billion to fund housing for people experiencing homelessness. Governor Gavin Newsom made clear last week that he will not entertain major tax proposals, declaring they're not part of the conversation. The pandemic's remote work culture has shown information-based companies that office location may not matter as much as once thought, while California's high housing cost regulations and taxes are certainly a deterrent. Further taxing the rich is proving to be political risk and a threat to the very system that makes it possible for California to thrive even in dark times. Just last month, Oracle and Hewlett-Packard Enterprise announced they were moving their headquarters to rival state Texas. Elon Musk, now the richest person on the planet, also said he was moving to the Lone Star State, though his company, Tesla, will remain in California. Advocates say another tax hike is overdue, but even without one, the state could change its priorities to make better use of its billions of dollars. It's all very frustrating since, with the fifth largest economy in the world, these things are fixable. The money is there, said Courtney McKinney, spokesperson for the Western Center on Law and Poverty. It's a question of priorities. Whether or not millions of people being plunged into poverty is seen as enough of a destabilizer to encourage the wealthy, business, and political class in California to put money into addressing poverty and the trappings of poor environment in smart, sensible ways. Easier said than done. Assemblymember Alex Lee, a Democrat from San Jose, a co-author of legislation to extend the eviction moratorium for another year, said resistance to more permanent solutions to help low-income residents is a reminder that California is not as progressive as it claims to be. In the November election, California proved it's not the liberal bastion people think it is. Besides rejecting the business property tax increase, they opposed affirmative action and rent control, while they sided with gig employers and dialysis companies instead of labor unions. Whether or not people should be evicted during a pandemic in a recession, even just having to fight about that says we aren't where we should be yet, Lee said. I think a lot of people are realizing this stuff, and that even though we have Democratic super ultra-majorities, we aren't living up to the progressive potential that we have. I would never characterize us as a progressive state. You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to RIB English Radio by your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
September 2nd, 2021. On the occasion of the National Government Week, President Raisi and the cabinet members met with Imam Khamenei in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya during the first days after the formation of the 30th administration.
I wish to raise a few points about foreign policy as well. Of course, there are many issues that need to be raised about foreign policy, which will be discussed in the right time and place. Briefly, foreign policy is very important, and it greatly influences the affairs of the country. we should be more active in the area of diplomacy. In diplomacy, the economic aspect should be strengthened because economic diplomacy is a very important matter. Today, one can see that although many countries have a foreign minister, presidents themselves discuss economic matters with other countries or with a specific country. In other words, economic relations with other countries are very important. Therefore, the economic aspect of diplomacy should be strengthened. And foreign trade is very important, especially with our neighbors.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
We have about 14-15 neighbors, comprised of large populations and offering a big market. But we should not confine ourselves to these countries. And we should establish such relations with other countries as well. There are about 200 plus countries in the world. We do not intend to establish relations with only a few countries, one or two countries. We might not be able to establish relations with some countries, but the possibility exists to establish good and constructive relations with most countries. Diligence is necessary to that end. Another point is that diplomacy should not be overshadowed by the nuclear matter. It should not be the case that the diplomacy of the country is dependent on the nuclear matter. The nuclear matter is a separate matter that should be resolved in a proper manner. But diplomacy is much wider in scope.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.